Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Okay, we have a jam-packed audience here at the Civic Center in Roswell. Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to the UFO Files. And we have a man who's lived in Roswell for a long time now, but you're not a native at all. And he's a good friend of ours and an expert on almost everything, from pyramids to Area 51 and Roswell, of course. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, but you know I hate that word expert.
Yeah, I know that, and that's the reason I used it. I thought I'd get you going really right off the bat.
Always a pleasure to be on with you, Jerry.
This is Dennis Balthaser, and he's got a great website. And why don't you tell us about it?
My website is TruthSeeker, all one word, TruthSeeker@Roswell.com. And I've tried to concentrate my research on four areas in the years I've been doing it. And that's the 1947 Roswell incident, Area 51 up in Nevada, which doesn't and hasn't existed, according to the government, since 1955. Underground bases, primarily because of my civil engineering background. My interest was STEM for that. And then a few years ago, I was asked to join the advisory board of the Great Pyramids of Giza, which has been just fascinating research for me.
Yeah, we've talked to you in detail about the pyramid show, and we'll do another one some of these days. They send you the information, and you kind of talk about it. Someday you're going to go over there.
Yeah, I'm planning on trying to get over there as quickly as I can. We have about 31 worldwide researchers, physicists, scientists, Egyptologists on the board from Russia, the Ukraine, from Italy, France, the United States, Canada. And these are all high-tech, highly educated people, and I was kind of curious why I was asked to get on it. But then I found out that there was some interest in the possibility of an ET connection with the building of the pyramids. And the factual information that we have tells us that the pyramids and the Sphinx are much, much older than we've been told over the years, so that's basically what we're researching.
And we do have a show of Dennis on our website if you'd like to check that out. Everything that we do is there for free for download 24/7 forever, and most of the shows are also MP3 iPodcast as well. Dennis, I wanted you to come on early on a show here simply because you knew Walter Haut very well, and you've talked to him over the years, and you've done a lot of investigation about all of this. And, in fact, you and Wendy
Connors
up in Albuquerque has fadeddisc.com. You guys made some videos, didn't you, and audios?
I got to know Walter really well because I was involved with the UFO Museum from 1996 until 1998. On the board of directors for a year, and also the UFO investigator for the museum during that time period when I was volunteering 70 hours a week at the museum. So I had the occasion to talk to Walter Haut, Glenn Dennis, the mortician at the time in 47, and I talked to them daily, not only about UFOs, but about their personal life and things like that. And Walter was doing an interview with a French documentary company.
Right, and we played an excerpt. Wendy gave us an excerpt.
In that interview, he made a comment about bodies. And I had never heard Walter talk about that before. And Wendy Connors and I both were sitting there when he made the comment, and we looked at each other, went outside, and said, "We have to get this on tape." So we worked with it and got his daughter, who is the director of the museum, and Walter, to agree for us to do an oral history on Walter. And what we wanted to do was to get Walter on videotape so that for historical value, if nothing else, and for his family, there would be some record of Walter's life, because he had an extremely interesting life. As a child, he grew up in the Chicago area. He worked in drugstores as a runner, would deliver things for the drugstore, and his favorite people to deliver to were the Capone family. And the reason he liked delivering to the Capone family was because everybody else tipped about 25 or 50 cents, and the Capone family would tip him $5 or $10 every time he delivered something. So he was a good businessman back then.
Yeah.
And then he entered the military and went through bombardier school. He had 35 missions over Japan as a bombardier, and he said he enjoyed that job because from the island where they were flying up to Japan was about a 15, 18-hour round trip, and he'd sleep on the way up. The pilot or the co-pilot would kick him on the shoulder up in the front of the airplane, wake him up. He'd set up his Norton bomb sights, drop the load, and then go back to sleep. So he said it was a good job. And then he had the fortune, I guess it's fortune, of being the man who dropped the instrument in the mushroom cloud when they tested the atomic bomb in the Pacific. And I used to kid him about that and ask him, did you glow? And he said, no, I didn't glow, but he said it was kind of bumpy going through the clouds. So that was pretty historical to be involved with that. And then was assigned here to Roswell under Colonel Blanchard and became the public relations officer. And during the interview that we did on videotape, and I'm going to have to admit, I haven't read the new book yet that has the affidavit in it. I've heard reviews and read reviews of it. But what I have seen of the affidavit, it is very precise as far as dates and locations and people. And that bothers me a little bit because in the oral history we did on videotape, Walter couldn't remember where he took basic training. He couldn't remember names. He couldn't do this or that. And there was a two-year gap. We did the interview on videotape in 2000. The affidavit was supposedly signed in 2002. So either he had a tremendous revision of his memory, or perhaps someone else wrote the document and he signed it. We don't know that, and that's something we're going to have to determine. So until I've had a chance to really study the affidavit and do some more research, basically that's all I know about it.
Well, basically you do know Walter, though, and I met him. He was in not very good health the day we talked to him, so we didn't put the interview on the air. In fact, he was rather weak-voiced even in 2000 in your show.
He was.
You did.
And that's one of the things that bothered us. Now, when we did the interview, and I love Wendy Connors tremendously, but I thought she led him on. She asked the same question over and over and over.
Until he answered, right?
Until he got an answer she wanted. And that's not a good way to do an interview or research. But there's a whole lot we have to look at this. And if the affidavit is correct, the new affidavit, the information is correct, then the video could possibly...
Well, let me run some things down that you know about him, and let me just ask you what you think about it. And first of all, he's purportedly, according to the new book, was a very good personal friend of Colonel Blanchard.
Very much. He, in fact...
Now, he was the commander of the base.
Colonel Blanchard was the base commander and head of the 509th Bomb Wing. He went on to become a four-star general and was considered for Joint Chief of Staff in Washington at the Pentagon. Had a heart attack in the war room at the Pentagon a day after he had a physical. But Walter and Colonel Blanchard were very close, and Walter talked a lot about... The old man would call me in and he'd say, what do you think about this? And he said, here I am, a lieutenant, and the colonel's asking me questions and wanting my advice. But when Colonel Blanchard passed away, I understand that Walter was one of the first people notified.
So that part, and we've known that before, they were very good friends. So this would explain how he, as a lieutenant, maybe was able to go out to the hangar where the bodies were. He says he saw... He told you he saw, what, one or two?
One body at the hangar.
Yeah, later on in this affidavit, they say two.
Yeah, he said he saw a body partially covered in a tarp from about 20 or 25 feet away, and he described it as child size.
In fact, in the affidavit, I think he says, or maybe in an interview that one of the researchers did, he said he was this high holding his hand up like a 10- or 11-year-old child.
Right. That was the same information we got.
Yeah. And so that part we know, at least there was one, maybe two. How many survivors or victims do you think, ETs I'm talking about, dead extraterrestrials, do you think there really were?
Well,
I have come up with a count of five. Is that right?
I've heard anywhere from three to five, and I've heard one or two still alive at the time. That all still has to be verified, but anywhere from three to five bodies.
Yeah, so... And the thing that I thought was interesting that grabbed my attention, I've been covering Roswell and UFOs for 40-some-odd years, and... I really wasn't aware of this this other, I call it an escape pod crash, but I don't know, about 45 miles from here. What can you tell me about that?
Stanton Friedman and I have talked about this, that comment that there's a site 40
right, and
miles.
I had Larry Dickin, the executive producer of our show, had a long conversation with Stanton about it. He's not convinced either.
I don't know where the site is. They're talking about a site 40 miles. In my lecture yesterday, I talk about three sites. One is the Corona debris site where Mac Brassel, the ranch foreman, found the material, which to me is the basically the only valid site that we have. Then you have the Corn Ranch site, which are promoted, they're promoting here at the convention this year, and they're taking tours out there. I got an affidavit from the McKnight children whose daddy owned that ranch in 1947, and they said nothing happened there. Corn bought the site a few years ago. He wasn't even born when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the other site that we talk about is the Ragsdale site out in the Capitan Mountain west of town.
Now he's passed away too.
1995, he passed away, but before he did, he gave two affidavits.
Yeah, and he has a DVD out of Deathbed Confession,
which the museum was promoting. I think there was some connection there between the profit from that for the museum and the research. And I never put any confidence in the Ragsdale site at all because it was two different affidavits, two different locations, two different stories, which has never been verified.
Now, his daughter lives here,
and
she runs a liquor store, I think.
I believe that's right, yeah.
So before we leave on Monday, we're going to try to track her down.
Okay.
But that's one of the things that I'd like to bring up as a researcher. I know it's got to be just... to make you want to pull your hair out, the Undertaker's beating us to the...
Well, that and the frustration. I lose between $2,000 and $4,000 a year doing this research, and my wife's good enough to let me do that. But I think what I'm doing is important, and I think the information, trying to determine the truth, is of such importance, maybe not to me. I went on Medicare in October, and everything's been downhill since then. But... You know, at my age...
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm not laughing about it, but I can identify with it. I'm a little older than you, even.
At my age, I used to think that we'll know the truth in my lifetime, and I've about given up on that, and I'm just hopeful that what I'm doing will help get the truth for my children or my grandchildren, because there's two things that bother me. One is the media, the national media. They don't represent us in any way, shape, or form. Stanton Friedman, Jesse Marcel, Don Schmidt, and I did a National Geographic special last year. That was one of the most biased shows I've ever been involved in. When it came out, it was an absolute disaster, and I'm convinced it was done for profit and ratings. Had nothing to do with factual information. The other concern I have is our young people in this country are accepting the fact that we live in a country of cover-up. The Kennedy assassination, Watergate, Vietnam, Iran-Contra, those are all cover-ups. And it's time for our young people to start asking questions of the government and demanding answers.
Dennis Balthaser is our guest here, and actually he pronounces his name Balthaser.
Balthaser,
right?
Balthaser, that's close enough.
Right, and I have a mental block with this. Dennis first came on the air with me, and the radio show is still available. From I think 2000 or 2001.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, and I had trouble with his name the first night, and 7 years later, I'm still having trouble. But that's okay. People call me Pipin.
I carry business cards so I can spell it.
Yeah. You talked about questions. We're going to go to the audience if they have some questions, and I have some more questions. We're broadcasting from Roswell, the 60th anniversary. I'm Jerry Pippin. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers. UFO and alien disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at ShopJerryPippin.com. Hello, everyone. Jerry Pippin, and we're back here with our UFO files, and we're broadcasting from Roswell, the 60th anniversary. Dennis Balthaser is our... almost got it. I didn't quite get it, but I got it close, Dennis.
Right. Very good, Jerry.
Yeah, yeah. He is our guest, truthseekers.com. Is that close enough?
Truthseeker at Roswell.
Yeah, okay, good. I want to get the whole thing here. We do have a link on all of this, so I'm saved by the bell. You guys were up in someplace else in Colorado, right? Or New Mexico. And you heard about this place. Is that right?
We listened to
Well, you can mention the competition. That's okay.
We listened to Coast to Coast.
It's not competition. We're all in this together.
Pretty much all, you know, every night. It's sort of our thing. And, you know, the fascination... we grew up during the 50s and 60s in Los Angeles, and I know there was lots of testing done in Nevada. Yeah. I remember when my mother would say to me, "We have to shut the windows and close the drapes because they're doing some testing," and I remember having to play inside. And my question is, what do we know? We talked about Hangar 51. What do you believe about the possibility that a lot of radiation did drift into the Los Angeles area? Because all of my friends, I'm 58 years old, and I'm...
You're kidding me.
No.
I thought I looked okay, but this lady, she doesn't look 58. Don't tell me your husband's the same age.
Yes,
I thought you married a child.
We grew up together. We met when we were 15 years old, and we were first loves, and... just got together 40 years later. But anyway, almost everyone I know my age in my class, we just had our 40th reunion, is afflicted with some kind of rare cancer or a disease that the onset was at a very early age.
Like right. We've got your name. We need to give you
Diane.
Okay.
I'd really like to know about the Hangar 51 and what went on in Nevada. And
she's talking about Area 51, Dennis, what about, we talked about medical problems earlier. There does seem to be a lot of...
there have been a lot of stories, conspiracy stories about radiation over the years that people were involved with this, had mysterious deaths. One, the most popular one, of course, is Congressman Schiff from New Mexico. He wound up with a facial cancer after he had requested information from the General Accounting Office. Was there a connection? I don't think so. But Area 51, we know they do toxic waste disposal on top of the ground. The President of the United States, starting with Bill Clinton, puts out a proclamation every year that can be picked up on the Internet, stating that Area 51, Groom Lake, which it's called up in Nevada, is exempt from environmental law. The only corporation, business, operation in the entire country that gets away with burning toxic fuel or toxic waste above ground. There were two gentlemen who died of exposure. Their wives, when they found out about it, their husbands worked at Area 51. They didn't know what they did. They filed lawsuit against the United States government. When that went to court, the judge wasn't allowed to look at the paperwork because of the secrecy with the base. And the judge told them, you can't sue something that doesn't exist, indicating that the base wasn't even there when it's been there since 1955.
Well, you were just up there.
I was up there last May, and I did two lectures at Rachel next to the little alien inn. I went out to both the gates, harassed the guards while I was there. There's a 13-mile dirt road from the extraterrestrial highway back towards the mountains where the base is located on the other side of the mountain. And I told my wife, I said, we get down here about 10 miles, start watching the hills because you'll see a Jeep or a truck, and they'll be looking for us. Well, we came around one of those little sand dunes to where the entrance is, where the signs are. Sure enough, sitting up in the hill was a pickup truck, two camo dudes, which are called the two guards in camouflage uniforms, binoculars watching us. They already had all the information on me they needed. They have sensors along the road coming in there They'll know your truck license number. They can run a check on you. By the time you get to the gate, they know who you are and where you're from and what you're doing. They also have systems set up where they can listen to you talk. That was at the back gate, which is the most popular gate. The other gate is where the guardhouse is. They have two gates, one with a stop sign. If that opens, you go in. There's another one. The back one closes. You don't go in there unless you're delivering something to the base. But they have a camera mounted about 30 feet in the air on a tower. And I walked down along the property line, and that camera followed me everywhere I went. If I stopped, the camera stopped. And I'd turn around, I'd wave at it every so often to let the guard know I was okay and doing it and doing my job. But one of the questions that I raise, we have a lot of problems with the border, with our Mexican border and Canadian border. Area 51 has been in existence since 1955. It was opened by the CIA to test the U-2 aircraft. Nobody has ever penetrated Area 51. So maybe on our border, we need a sign that says the use of deadly force is authorized. Maybe we can do something about that border. Have them guards sitting there, loaded rifles, ready to go. If you should happen to go across up there, you're going to be brought into the sheriff's office. They'll contact the local sheriff. You'll be interrogated. You may be fined anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, and I'll guarantee you they'll know where you're at for the rest of your life. But on the conspiracy theory, on the cancer, I don't see a connection. I think maybe it's partially a conspiracy.
Okay, you know, Dennis, when we talk about that, there's even a conspiracy theory that maybe Congressman Schiff was given this cancer because he was really wide open to investigating UFOs.
Yeah, there's been several researchers that have had kind of mysterious deaths. Going back to 1947, James Forrestal, when was Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy, when he was admitted to the hospital with mental problems, he jumped out of the hospital and committed suicide. But the room he was in at the hospital is the only room that didn't have bars on the window. So the conspiracy theory is that he was helped out that window because he was going to go public with information. Marilyn Monroe, Don Burleson did a lecture yesterday that the Kennedy association with Marilyn Monroe had something to do with her death. These are all theories we don't know. Good question.
Okay, this is Jerry Pippin, and we deal in conspiracies a lot, and as Dennis says, that's the reason they're conspiracy theories, is we don't get too many people to talk, which I you know, my big deal is I like to get people to tell me the real truth, and basically when they're facing huge fines, prison sentences, ostracization from everybody else they worked with, they usually just don't talk. Can't really get them. Your name, sir?
Joe Bookman.
And where are you from?
Park City, Utah.
Okay, welcome to Roswell. You have a question for Dennis or a statement?
I do. I'm curious. Go back to the Foster Ranch in July of 47. What's your theory about what was happening 1 minute before the debris started falling? Was there one ship that exploded or two ships that bumped each other? Or can you go back in time just a little bit before the first thing hit the ground?
Yeah, Dennis, we've had all kinds of theories, and there seems to be a shoot-down theory now going on.
Yeah, well, here we go again with theories.
Yeah, okay, I'm just curious about your best guess or informed research.
Let me give you my best guess first, and what we've heard from ranch foreman Mac Brassel, who was the ranch foreman on the Foster Ranch near Corona. He said that he heard an explosion louder than thunder on the night of July 4th, 1947, about 11:30 at night, during a severe thunderstorm. Now, out here in the southwest, we can have a thunderstorm 60 miles away from here, and here in Roswell, the stars are out and the moon's shining. That's typical. So we have gone back and checked weather reports, and yes, there was a storm. Now, this rancher would know the sound of a thunderstorm. The next morning, he went out to check on his sheep and his windmills for damage from the storm the night before. His sheep wouldn't go across the debris field. Took them around it to get them to water. One of the theories that Stanton Friedman talks about is a two-vehicle crash west of here, out near the plains of St. Augustine, west of Socorro. His theory is that they had a mid-air collision. One went down at the Plains of St. Augustine. The other one came in and came down at the Corona Ranch. Schmidt and Randall, in their book in the early 90s, talked about the craft hit the ground at the Corona site, went airborne, and crashed at the Corn Ranch site. I believe the Corn Ranch site was a diversionary site. I don't think anything ever happened there because of the affidavit I got from the McKnight family. Bragsdale talked about a flash in the sky brighter than a welder's arc, and that the thing came in to Boy Scout Mountain, where him and his girlfriend were laying in the back of a pickup, buck naked, having a good time, end quote.
These New Mexico guys know how to live.
You bet. We don't put a lot of confidence in that. There's also a theory about it being shot down, perhaps. Now, one theory that has come up that I'm wanting to look at is the use of microwave radar. There were remote microwave radars set up at Fort Sumner. There were some up at Moriarty. The military has some of these set up somewhere. Depending on the propulsion system and guidance system of these craft, that type of radar could interfere with it, as could a thunderstorm with lightning. Depending where they're from, if they don't know what lightning is, the electrical storm could have had an effect on the guidance or the propulsion system. Most times when an aircraft goes down, be it a commercial or a military airplane, it's usually pilot error. Very seldom is it mechanical problems. But just based on the fact that this could be something from out there, they may not have been used to the microwave or to the electrical storm.
On the crash, if it were a shoot down or a collision, and we had the surviving ET, do you have any information on the one or two that possibly survived? What's your best guess about that? Do you just not know if anyone thinks survived?
Well, if I don't know, I'll tell you. But my best guess is that the bodies were probably taken, as was the debris, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, which was Wright Field back then. The reason for that was they had research and development there from the Second World War with things we had captured from the Germans during the Second World War. They also had cold storage facilities there for bodies. Now, I have heard stories that there possibly could have been a body taken to Los Alamos, a national lab in northern New Mexico, even down to White Sands. This state is just absolutely full of secretive stuff. And most people don't realize New Mexico is just a gold mine for secrets and military and high-tech stuff that takes place.
But that's true.
But I think most researchers agree that the material and the bodies were probably taken to Wright Field in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio.
Anyone else have a question? Yes. Come this way a little bit. Our microphone cord, we don't have one of
those
wireless.
You know, for 20 cents, you could have got another foot of mic cord. Right.
My name is Diane also. I'm from Katy, Texas.
Katy, Texas.
Yes. I would like to know what happened to the nurse that went. The nurse that went in and actually saw the body.
You know the Glenn Dennis story?
What happened to the nurse? I hear that she was engaged and her fiancé never heard from her again.
Well, the story we have from Glenn Dennis, who was a mortician in 47, was that he went to the base infirmary, the hospital, and a nurse he knew came out of a room with her face covered, nauseated, and told him to get out of there. The next day, she said she wanted to meet Glenn Dennis at the officers' club. They met, and on the back of a prescription pad, she drew a picture of a face of an alien and the hands of an alien. She gave that to Glenn Dennis. He called back the next day because he said she was very upset. He called back the next day to check on her and was told that she had been shipped out to Europe. And he wrote to her, and his letter supposedly came back with a red stamp on it, said deceased. Now, the story he got was that she was killed in a plane crash in Europe. There is no record of a plane crash in Europe. Glenn has not changed his story over the years very much. I'm one of the few researchers that has a problem with his story. We can't find any of the witnesses that he talked about. The 6'2" red-headed captain that threatened him, said you get your bones picked out of the desert. The nurse, But more importantly, he supposedly took that picture, that drawing, and put it in a safe at Ballard Funeral Home, where he was the mortician. Years later, Stanton Friedman and him went to the Ballard Funeral Home to get this piece of paper out of the safe, and it wasn't there. Glenn doesn't know whether he lost it or if it was taken. So he sent two researchers on a wild goose chase for 5 years with the name of the nurse. Gave him the wrong name.
Dennis, you knew Glenn. Did you ever ask him about that?
I asked him many times, and his story didn't change. But that's one of the problems I have. But you can see where these two pieces of evidence would be extremely important. Getting that piece of paper with the drawing of the alien face and the hands, and then secondly, the nurse disappearing and no record of that. Glenn today will tell you that she was a Catholic, and she went to a convent, thank you, that she was in a convent, and that he's protecting her. He didn't want to give her name because he wanted to protect her.
He just gave me the killed in action story.
Yeah. I don't know what the relationship was. Glenn was a married man at the time. And I don't know what his relationship was with the nurse, and I'm probably speaking out of turn here by doing this, but if that's the truth, I want it out.
He was a friend of hers.
He was a friend. Yeah, we know that.
Men and women can be friends.
My other question is...
You pay for two questions?
Sure.
We doubled our money.
Okay.
We see green aliens everywhere, and then I heard yesterday... Somebody said they weren't green.
I don't know of any little green men, do you?
The statement, they weren't green, goes back to Mac Brazel, the rancher. He came to town, was interrogated out of the base for several days. When he left town, he stopped at the radio station, KGFL, talked to Frank Joyce, and changed his story.
Oh.
He said what he had seen was actually 2 weeks ago instead of last week, and that it was a weather balloon, and he was wrong about what he had seen after being interrogated.
Scared.
And then...
Yeah, they kept him without a warrant or any charges.
And then Frank Joyce at the radio station said, Mac, he said, are you talking about those little green men? And Mac spun around in his cowboy boots and said they weren't green.
Well, I wish he had said what color they were.
And that was the only comment he ever made about the bodies. Now... The aliens that you see on books and on magazines with the big eyes and stuff like that sells product. Most people here refer to the aliens in Roswell as almost humanoid looking, except for size. Mm-hmm. They have a humanoid appearance to them, but they have larger eyes, longer arms. The number of fingers changes, 3, 4, 5, whatever. But they're not the grays that you see on TV. That's not what crashed here. They're more humanoid.
I have one other comment. A couple of weeks ago when I first came to Roswell, I went to a garage sale, and the man that had the garage sale retired from Area 51. So I...
Well, where was that garage sale? I need to go...
I'm not going to say.
I'm going to get sign her on here.
Will you share that with me later?
sure. And, you know, of course, he said nothing, and I'm a novice. The big tie I have to this is I was born in 1947. So
well,
I'm,
that explains a lot of it right sure. there then. If yeah, you were born in 47.
Right. It's a good year.
You're interviewing an alien.
Yes. I was in vitro at the time. Almost born. But everybody seems to know about the Area 51.
Well, it went public. We found out about it through a Russian satellite picture.
Yeah, I
American people were lied to for years. Mm-hmm. It was opened in 1955 by the CIA to test the U-2 aircraft. They needed a location to test that airplane that was secretive. Edwards Air Force Base wasn't secretive enough. And every airplane since then has been test flown there. A good example of the American government able to keep secrets, the F-117 Stealth, which is located at Holloman Air Force Base down the road from here, that was on the drawing board in 1973. We found out about it in 1991 in the Gulf War.
So it couldn't have been flying before 73?
The F-117?
Right.
No. No.
What, the Stealth?
No. We don't think so.
No.
Okay. Right, thank you very much. You know, you talk about the government and their how to keep secrets. they're masters at redirection, I've found. In other words, if you get a little information about something, they'll give that up. It's kind of like a poker game. Yeah, okay, you got that. And then they just push everything that way, away from the real place.
And Jerry, that's a good point. That's what I'm trying to emphasize to the audience this morning, is that let's start asking questions and demanding answers of our government. You know, we can't continue to live with this cover-up. At lectures, I ask people, name five people in the government you respect. I'm getting the same blank look this morning.
Yeah, you're true. It's a good point. And the problem is, these guys seem to think that we work for them, and it's the other way around.
We the people.
Yeah, supposedly. Dennis Balthaser, it's always great to have you here. We could go on for hours, but we have other guests.
So,
thank you very much, and let's plug that website one more time.
Thank you. TruthSeeker@Roswell.com.
This is Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer, or really any time, that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over two decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tours. UFO Files with Jerry Pippin. We're live here recording. You'll hear this later, but as you can tell, we have a studio audience. We'll probably go to the audience before it's over. It's a pleasure to have our next guest. The Paranormal Radio Network is how I best know him, but he has a big UFO background, and we'll get into that in a minute. Let's say hello to Joe Montalvo.
Yeah. I'm glad.
Tell us, you know, when do you do your shows here?
Actually, we're going to be following you most of the week.
Oh, okay.
Today we do have a support group meeting for ICAR. It's an abduction support group meeting that'll be held when y'all are finished today. We'll actually be using this room for an abduction support group meeting, which is we only get to do when we can attend conferences.
Yeah, yeah. Now tell us a little bit about your UFO part first before we get into the radio part.
Okay. I'm international director for ICAR, which is basically we're an abduction-based organization. We mainly research abduction cases. We do UFOs. We have added the UFO division in the last few weeks. Because of demand, we are now the largest UFO alien abduction organization on the planet. Far larger than MUFON had ever reached in its heights. So we're very serious about this. We do a lot of work. We spend a lot of money on this. At this conference alone, I think we have 20 or 30 contactees present that will be either doing interviews or at the panel discussion later today. I also, tomorrow, will be giving an abduction lecture in the workshop right behind this room as well. For me, I've been doing this about 25 years. I've been doing alien abduction research now for just about 25 years. ICAR itself has investigated over 7,000 cases.
Where is this organization based out of? You probably have several.
Well, the home base is New Orleans, Louisiana, which Katrina tried to wipe out. But
yeah,
I was trying to ask
you about that.
I was very fortunate. My house only got about 3 inches of water.
That's good.
I was very, very fortunate.
Okay, do you have local chapters around? Is that the deal?
Yes, we do. We have several states with directors in them now. We also have clinical hypnotherapists in several of the states now as well. We try to offer kind of a counseling support as well for these people, because I notice a lot of the contactees tend to have emotional unstable problems. Some of them have drug abuse, alcohol abuse problems, things like that, which we do refer to professional counselors for that, but. We do try to help these people to come to terms with these contacts and try to understand them better and really try to incorporate them into their life.
You know, when you talk about this, when you first got interested in this, to now in this journey of 25 years, had the story changed a lot from what you thought it'd be like?
Actually, I have to be honest. When I first got involved with this, I thought these people were crazy. I'm really? Not even going to lie about it. After about 10 years of research, I realized it was something.
So you just dismissed it early on. It interested you because probably they had a psychological problem or something.
Well, I had met a particular person who was very gifted, very talented, had a very high IQ, but they kept telling me they were being visited by aliens. And I was like, there's...
Well, that isn't a normal conversation.
No, it's
so
not.
So we understand.
But, you know, I understood who the person was, so it didn't seem like they were looking for attention. And they definitely weren't crazy. So, you know, I had to kind of stop and think, well, maybe there's something going on. I'll keep looking and maybe I'll find a reason for it. Well, 7,000 cases later, I'm convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that this is something that happens on a pretty fairly regular basis amongst contactees, and it seems to run bilateral, generational through families. We have several cases we're working where there's six or seven generations in the same family. A matter of fact, one of the groups will be speaking here today.
Now when you take these 7,000 cases, and if you were an attorney and went to court, you probably could win a circumstantial case that these people are being abducted.
There's more than enough circumstantial evidence to win a court case. I don't know if we could ever get one, but I would love to try to sue the government for the existence of abduction cases. But then if you won the case, I'm scared it would start a massive lawsuit against the government. And I don't want to be known for that one. So.
Now, when we talk about that, though, when we lay out this evidence, that is one of the problems. It has to be circumstantial. Or have you found lots of backup evidence, physical evidence?
There is some trace evidence. Mm-hmm. Not enough for me to say it's conclusive evidence. I'm sure some people would argue a different point. For me, it's going to be more conclusive when I can drag E.T. in here and put him on the microphone.
Well, right. You and I have the same ambition. We want to knock on the saucer door and say, hey, come on out.
Let's do an interview.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know. Talk to me.
But and that's what makes it tough. I mean, circumstantial evidence is great for a court of law, but for science, it's not. Scientists want hard, credible evidence so that they can prove this beyond a reasonable doubt.
So basically what we have is very little real evidence, scientific evidence to back things up, but we have a huge amount of the population, when you stop and think about it. How many, you know, if you carry your 7,000 cases forward, how many people, we do a little thing on our radio show about maybe millions of people have been abducted.
Well, we figure it like this. If you take the 7,000 cases and you realize that most of their family are probably contactees, that 7,000 just ballooned into about 200,000. If you take that as only 2% of the population who are abducted report an abduction, that increases to somewhere around 1.5 billion.
Said billion as is Betty. Right? Not million.
No, as in billions.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And when we hear these kind of numbers, we all kind of go, well, that's an impossibility. But when you really understand that, when you start looking at the caseloads bilateral across the planet, and you start looking, because we're not the only ones doing this research, probably most prominent, but we're not the only ones, I could probably, there's probably 15 or 20,000 cases in the United States that are being investigated by several different groups. And we do estimate that it's less than 2% of contactees that come forward. And that's based on families. You know, you'll get one person in a family who'll come forward when you know there's five or six others in the family that are contactees.
Well, there's people in the audience I've talked to here between shows, and more than one has said, well, I didn't know that Aunt Joe or Aunt Betty or Uncle Joe had an abduction story. But they had something they're going to tell me about when I told them I was coming to Roswell. I mean, that happens all the time.
It's common. It's commonplace. And what you're going to find out is, through research, we found out that if mom's being abducted, more than likely grandpa and grandma was abducted, great-grandmama was abducted, and so on and so forth back. But when you come forward, the grandchildren are being abducted, the children are being abducted, the great-grandchildren are being abducted. Now, we know this because we have several cases now. And when you start thinking about this, if you take that 7,000 and start adding in their family lines, and a lot of times contactees have a tendency to group up together. They have a unique way of finding each other. I'm not even sure how, Jerry, to be honest with you. But somehow or another, whether it's via the internet, malls, conventions, they have a way of finding each other. So a lot of times what you find when you find one contactee, you'll usually find 10 or 15 of their friends or associates that are having the same type of experiences. So when you start adding up friends and family, you come up with some very large numbers. It's actually kind of scary when you sit down and think about it, that this many people on our planet could be taken either against their will. Some of them say to cooperate, but some of them say it's against their will, without any cooperation from our government. I mean, somebody's got to know. It's just, there's no way this could go on this large of a scale without somebody knowing about it.
Well, Joe, what do you think's going on here? I mean, why are they taking these people?
Boy, isn't that the question?
Yeah. You've investigated a lot of people.
Well, see, our problem is we found that this has been going on a really long time. When I first got involved, I thought aliens...
It was something recent.
I thought, you know, Roswell was the start of it. Mm-hmm. When I started doing research and realizing that you can go back as far as the Sumerians and find contact experience, well, I realized right then and there, they're not here to conquer the planet, because if they were, they would have done it 6,000 years ago when there was, 20 million of us. Would have been a much easier job. If they were truly here to guide us and help us, well, they would have started 6,000 years ago. We'd be a much more enlightened species and a much more advanced species.
You know, if they were helping us, they didn't do a very good job.
My point exactly. So the thing of it is we've realized that, especially with the Greys, they have their own agenda, and humans are simply part of that agenda. We're not even the whole agenda. We're just part of it. And then you have to stop and wonder, because, you know, when you start looking at the Greys are running several types of experiments, from what we like to call emotional response experiments to different types of breeding experiments. So several other types of physical experiments that go along with those. So, you know, we know that they're doing these, so it kind of makes it hard to really pin down an agenda per se as far as why they decided to pick on this particular race. There's a lot of speculation. And what we started doing about 1995, we started programming contactees when they were having contact to subconsciously ask, why is this happening? Why do you want me? Why are you abducting in my family? Why is this going on? And why is it going to go on for much longer?
So in other words, you're trying to get the abductees you're working with, the next time they're abducted, to ask.
To ask.
Have you been successful with that?
With a lot of the contactees and keepers we have been. Abductees, not so much.
What are the answers?
Most of them have answers like they're breeding a new segment of this population for colonization somewhere else. Now, that bothers me in the fact that why would they do that if we're all happy and healthy living here? You know, those kind of things beg you to kind of go, what's going on here? But a lot of when you ask them will tell you that they're developing stuff like host bodies or husk bodies where they can transfer consciousness. It's almost like they're expecting something to happen on this planet. Some of the contactees say they're actually here watching, observing, and preparing part of the species for when this happens, so that this species will survive one way or another.
The 2012 scenario, more or less.
More or less, yeah. And that's another thing that I find interesting, because if you look at all the religious texts, it kind of points to the same thing. If you start looking at a lot of like the Oracle of Delphi, even Notre Dame and the Aztecs and the Mayans and all, it starts pointing to a particular event. Now, if 2012 is a date, I'm sure we're going to all find out here real soon, because it's not very far away. I'm kind of skeptical about the 2012 date because of the way it was decoded, but still, it is quite in the realm of possibility. What bothers me, Jerry, is you have the alien contactees, the religious people, the religious fanatics, the different psychic people. It's all coming together at one point now, and that's a little bit more than a coincidence. At first, you could say, well, maybe it's coincidence that Notre Dame and the Aztecs are saying basically the same thing. But well, now you have five or six different areas that are seeming to fold in to one spot.
Are you saying we're acting out of play? It's predestination?
I don't know if it's predestined or if... In one aspect, I guess it is predestined in the fact that somewhere along the line, somebody had an idea that something was going to happen to this planet several generations back or several thousand years back. What that is exactly, that's anybody's guess. It's a question we ask to every contactee that we meet. Do you have any information?
In the advertising, and we deal with that because we're in broadcasting, perception is reality, and if you keep talking about a certain product long enough, people begin to accept
that.
That's so true. That may be part of this action.
Yeah, it is. Now, what's weird is we have one full third of all of our contactees have what we like to call the Holocaust stream. Now, this isn't a dream of global disaster, per se, like a meteor hit, you know, the caldera blown up. Mm-hmm. What they're talking about, basically, is they'll describe, like one lady was telling me about Houston. She said she was driving into Houston, and all she could see was mounds of bodies and bulldozers moving the bodies. But there was no physical damage to the city itself. She said there was some fires out of control and stuff like that. Now, I've heard this now about 1,800 times from about 1,800 different kinds, and they give almost identical descriptions. That's what
And these are people who had no way to talk to the other people.
No, they don't. They're not.
Some of them might have read something on the internet, but not all of them.
Well, actually, until just recently, none of this was made public. We hadn't made any of this public. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, a lot of the abduction criteria we use to determine who's a contactee and who's not, it still hasn't been made public. For the simple fact, we'll never know who's lying and telling the truth. But with these Holocaust dreams, they get into quite a bit of detail. What it seems like is it seems like there is some kind of virus or plague that swept across this planet in a matter of 3 or 4 days and killed 2/3 of the population. Well, we all know with the biological weapons that both the Russia, United States, and China have now that that's not beyond the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. They also say that contactees are immune to it. Whatever it is will leave the contact segment of the population intact.
Well, if we want to use some logic, and then maybe that's the real simple reason of the abductions and the hybrid program, is to make sure the human race stays.
Yeah, it does seem like they have a vested interest in us surviving. I wish I knew why, but it seems more than just a passing interest. It seems like a very focused effort. And we're not talking about one alien race here. Best we can tell, we're talking about the Greys, the human types, and what people like to call the reptilians. We call them amphibians, but they like to call them reptilians. We found that over the years, the reptiles have webbed hands and webbed feet and are warm-blooded, so it kind of rules them out of being reptiles.
Yeah.
But they do look a lot like a lizard. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of strange in itself. But all in all, you know, when we sit down and look at the three different types, it seems to be that they're working in an orderly, progressive manner towards a specific goal with several underlying sub-agendas. We tried to put this on one agenda. We really did as a group. We really tried to, but you can't. There's too many other things going on.
Do you think all the three groups are working in unison, or are they separate?
It looks like the Greys are the big boss, and everybody else is just doing their agendas. And the reason why is, Jerry, is at first, I used to hear stories back in the 70s that the Greys worked for the Palladians, or the human-type aliens, the Nordaks, and then, or sometimes they worked for the reptilians. So, you know, I kind of went along those premises. Well, after doing enough research, you will find that some contactees will have an experience where there's a human and a gray present. But there are human contactees, the gray seems to be observed. And you'll see that in reptilians. You do not see that in gray contacts. Gray contactees are exclusive gray contacts. So they also tell you when a gray is present in a ship, when there's an abduction going on, what other races there will give way to the grays. They will actually move out of their way. A lot of contacts say there's almost even a little bit of fear there. Like if they didn't get out the way, something nasty might happen to them.
Hey, have you had stories of anybody witnessing nasty things happening? I mean, like
not so much to the aliens, now to each other. That's not an uncommon thing.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah, that's not uncommon.
But the aliens, not to each other.
Not as far as we can tell. Now, okay. There is a group now that swears there's a rogue group of grays running around. There is some evidence for it, but nothing that we can really put our fingers on.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to him about his UFO program he does, and we'll go to the audience for some questions as well. You're going to write a book? You have a book or something?
Richard Dolan just got on to me, Jerry, about that. He told me, when are you going to write a book? To be honest with you,
I was talking to a couple of the people that helped me on the shows, and I say, well, you know, he's so active. I'm sure he's got a book, too. You must have left it out.
I can't. Well, I'm not a writer. I have tried. I swear I have tried to sit down and write a book. I'm not a writer.
But he's quite a broadcaster. We'll be back with Joel Montalvo in a minute. I'm Jerry Pippin, and this is the UFO Files.
Tales of the strange and the unknown. Every month in Fate magazine.
Fate.
Fate magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the strange and the unknown.
We are here at the Civic Center in Roswell, New Mexico, the 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash. Joe Montalvo is with us, and Joe, when is your broadcast on the one you do?
Oh, UFO Undercover airs on Wednesdays, 7 to 9.
And they can find that on the website. You have programming on the Paranormal Radio Network from 4 o'clock on is live, I think.
From 4 to midnight, 7 days a week, we broadcast live.
Is that Central or Eastern?
Central time. Central time. Everything's based on Central time.
And, well, good. There's two of us that do things on Central Time.
I like it better that way,
too. now you actually have a 24-hour operation, or more or less, so people in the daytime. You have a huge audience of office listeners, which is what we all do.
And which is
they're supposed to be
audience.
Working, but they're listening to our shows.
I'm happy. Tune in.
It's the American way. Yeah. But it's not only the American way. It's the Australian way and a lot of other ways.
Yeah, because they all seem to be listening, so...
Okay, what's your name?
My name is Dan Garcia.
Okay, where are you from?
I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay, you have a question for Joe?
Yes, I do, sir. I was just wondering...
Sir, I like this guy already.
Trying to give some respect here. I was reading recently about abduction and the correlation to sleep paralysis, how some people feel that abduction, particularly at night, is really sleep paralysis, and I was wondering if maybe you had any insight on that.
Actually, in some cases, it is sleep paralysis. The problem, and there's a big misnomer with abductions, about 75% of all abductions usually happen in the daytime while you're driving, usually to or from work. It's usually a scenario where it's something that you do on a fairly regular basis. It makes it a lot easier to program your memories when it's a scenario, because what they'll do is they'll just clip a piece of memory and put it in your head like you just were driving to work. But most abductions do happen in the daytime and while you're driving. But there are a lot of them that do fall into sleep paralysis. Some of them fall into abuse cases, things along those lines. You'll be surprised some of the stuff that gets blamed on aliens. But we do pick and go through all of this.
And a lot of programs talk about, you know, it happens in your sleep. There's a lot of evidence. A lot of it happens while you're driving a car.
Yeah, and that's what it is.
At 70 miles an hour, you're probably not...
That always amazed me, that one. I'm like, what do they do, grab your car and just suck it up while you drive? But, hey, that's where most of the reports come in from. So that's one of the things that helps lend a little bit more credibility to the field, too.
Yeah, now, in Albuquerque, there's all kinds of things happening there. Sandia Base, right down the road, the Air Force Base, all kinds of stories. You had any contact?
Myself, you mean alien contact?
Personally, right.
Well, personally, yeah.
Or with a secret agent, you can tell me a big story. I don't care.
they said they would assassinate me if I did. No, I'm kidding. No, the reason I asked specifically...
I'm offering you fame. Let's talk.
There we go. Wonderful. No, the reason I specifically asked about the sleep paralysis is because I had an episode after reading The Path of the Skinwalker where I have had a sleep paralysis like most of my life, but I had one where I saw like it looked like the face of a gray as it was dissolving the inside of my eyelids and had the buzzing. It just seemed really specific, and so that's sort of what predicated my question.
Well, I'll tell you what, and when Mr. Pittman's through today, there's going to be a support group meeting held right here. It's all contactees, so come by and see it, and you'll probably learn a lot from them.
And I'm pretty impressed that he called me Mr. Pippin. Joe, what do you mean by that? You mean I'm a damn old guy and you don't want to...
No. You always got to have respect for the people who've been doing it.
Anybody else have a question about abductions? Okay, well, we've got plenty, so we will continue along here and talk. We brought up an interesting subject there. Where do these people get abducted? Joe, is there a common denominator?
Yeah, usually it does seem, in a lot of the cases that they're picked up, usually when they're traveling. A lot of times it's work, but I can guarantee you on this particular conference, probably a good third of the group that was driving in had some type of contact. Most of them will realize it, you know, as time progresses during the conference, but I've already heard two of them since we've been
wait,
here.
Wait, they're on their way to Roswell, they leave Pennsylvania, they're going to drive 3,500 miles, and they have something happen to them on the way.
Yeah?
We have some Pennsylvania people.
Yeah. They dropped you off, huh? Just in time for the conference. That's a good thing.
No, I remembered him because not everybody drives 3,500 miles to hear the Jerry Pepin show. So, you know, it made an impression on me. Mm-hmm. In fact, she's nice enough to go over to our booth and buy a T-shirt. So,
yeah, I got to support the radio.
Yeah. So you're actually saying that people have, missing time, I guess, is the best evidence.
Well, actually, no, gain time is.
Missing, oh, really?
Missing time was one of those things that it seemed was very prominent up until about 94. And we all of a sudden, we couldn't find any cases that had missing time. We were like, well, what's going on here? Did aliens just quit doing what they were doing? We started getting these reports where, I'll give you a particular case out of Pensacola, Florida. There was a couple down there in Pensacola, Florida, left their hotel, right, was driving out to the beach. Now, they left their hotel at 11 o'clock, went and spent some time on the beach. They come back to the car, they get in the car, there's a ticket in the car for 10:05.
But
they didn't get to the beach till 11. Now the hotel cameras show them at 11, and the clerk at the store, when they were changing chips, remembered seeing them. The ticket was dated 10:05. Contacted the office, that's what time the car was parked at, that's when I wrote the ticket. No mistake in time, good credible witnesses all the way around. The person, when they came back, they had gained an hour's worth of time.
How do you explain that?
It seems like in the last decade or so that the extraterrestrials have changed some of what they do in abductions. And I think that had a lot to do with the researchers at hand
We
were catching on. So I figured that they changed it. It seems like they have the ability to step out of time. It's not like they time travel. It's more like we'll have contactees that will call us that went to bed and woke up the next morning with 3 weeks' worth of growth on their legs or a full beard the next morning. Well, we both know you don't grow a beard overnight. These contactees were actually missed, and then when you start regressing them, they'll have like 3 weeks worth of memories in their heads.
Wow, 3 weeks, it could end up on a milk carton.
So we found that they somehow have the ability to just focus the time. They'll usually bring you back 5 or 10 or 15 minutes before they pick you up, which I find really strange. This seems like there should be a paradox in there somewhere, yeah. But it seems to work fine for them, and it's something that, you know, it took a while to figure out what was going on. It took a while to catch on to how this was being done because we were getting really confused. We were always looking for missing time because that's what it was. Then also we got these reports where people wake up in the morning and find like a pile of sand on their floorboard. Go look at their car, that's 480 miles on their car. Well, as far as they know, they went to bed that night. We actually started tracing these cases. We found these people. They were getting up in the middle of the night, driving down to Navarre Beach, Florida, 10, 15 carloads at a time. Going out on the beach and just disappearing. We had crews out there searching the beach, just disappearing. 5 o'clock in the morning, they were back, boom, driving back to the house. Remembers none of it. We even got a couple of them on video. They remember absolutely nothing. They were somehow summoned down there, picked up, dealt with, put back down and drove home. I'm thinking, well, E.T., why don't you just fly over there and pick them up?
Yeah, I've had guests on and people, experiencers, who more or less say they have little they congregate in a place like mm-hmm. The military uses a staging area.
Yep.
And that's what these people are, the ETs are.
Well, Navarre, after the last 15 years of research, we have got cases where families have come down from like Wisconsin, spent the week down there, had 1 day's receipts for food, maybe 2 days worth of pictures, and the other 5 days nothing. Just nothing. Hotel cameras show they weren't in the hotel. The rental car was still there. There was no charges on their credit cards. They were just gone, the whole family. And then, you know, they get back, and they're kind of confused because they know they've been in Gulfport, in Navarre for 7 days, but they can only remember a day or two.
When we talk about things like this, and you're in Florida, we're out here in New Mexico, there's no really restriction on where these abductions occur, evidently. I mean,
it doesn't seem that time or space bothers them at all. They seem to reach across our planet quite easily.
I mean, we have people reporting from Manhattan all the time. So, I mean, the big city, little city, out in the desert, doesn't make any difference.
But what's interesting, if you take Larry Hatch's global map and you look at it, and you go back over the last 60 years, because he's got it where you can layer it, you'll see a pattern emerge, and especially in the free world.
That's what I was after. I knew you'd been doing the kind of research. Tell me about that pattern.
Well, we started finding out, especially in the free world countries, that they were congregating. You know, everybody always thinks abductions happen in rural areas, which is true. They do happen in rural areas. 90% of all abductions happen in big cities. New York City is the number one city for abductions, with Mexico City following right closely
behind. And that's
behind
a large city, too.
And, you know, the big cities seem to be where they're concentrated. And I guess it makes sense because there's more people there, one-stop shopping, kind of,
to say.
And they seem to want to congregate in specific areas in these cities. You'll find, like, Navarre seems to be a hot spot for some reason, Pensacola. No one really knows why. Maybe it's because Eglin Air Force Base is there or whatever, but it seems to be a hot spot. New York City is definitely a hot spot. I mean, I'm sure you remember the case where the lady was floating out of a window.
Sure, and we have people email us all the time from New York City and tell us incidents.
Yeah, and it's one of the hotter spots in the United States. Los Angeles is as well. I'm not exactly sure who they're abducting in Los Angeles, but I got a lot of friends out in L.A., but I got to give them a hard time. They do seem to be if you really look, you'll find that about 90% of the cases are in large cities or near large cities. You'll also find patterns like they tend to prefer areas where there's deep water or deep water channels. You'll find along like the Mississippi River, the Gulf Coast, the Atlantic and West Coast, you'll find a platitude of abduction cases.
Well, and we talk about deep water UFO sightings, underwater sightings. Any evidence from these people who have been abducted that they've been experienced? What kind of place do they take them to usually? Is it always the same a room with look like on a spaceship, or where do they go?
We call for the Grays, we call it the Star Room, or the Green Room would be a better thing for it. It's in a holding area, but it's in a holding area that seems to have a holographic generator because each person describes it differently. One person will tell you, well, they were sitting in a forest of trees with the Grays there. One will tell you that there were stars surrounding them. Another tell you they might be in their living room. But what we found out is this particular holding room, somehow or another, either picks up what the person's thinking and generates it physically or generates it mentally, but that's what the person thinks they're seeing. And we found out because a few of the people remember seeing the room as just the room, as just a white room with nothing in it at all.
These are people without an imagination.
I mean, there's got to be a specific reason why they didn't trigger it. And it might be that, or they might not be as imaginative as someone else, or they may have come more to terms with their contact and they don't need to be lied to.
That's probably the truth right there.
But
Joe Montalvo, we're almost out of time. Anything you'd like to bring up here? We need to talk about that radio show again.
Guys, please tune in to UFO Undercover on Wednesday.
Not that he's begging, but...
please tune in. We need more ratings, the better. Yeah. Also, please join us on www.paranormalradionetwork.com. You'll find an array of interesting shows, both ranging from paranormal with several of our more famous ufologists now on the network with us. So it's a good place to come in and learn and inform. We do have both toll-free numbers and virtual interactive audiences, so you can join, ask questions live, and harass them, whoever you want to harass, and myself included, so you can do that. Also, if you've had any type of contact or any type of sightings, the best place to go for that would be www.icar1.com.
And we have links to all of that and the description and text right up about it. Joe Montalvo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
And until next time, I'd like to thank Roberta Scott, our location producer, Jane Swartley, our editor. Cheers.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.